This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
It's been almost 10 years since the Kyoto Protocol was adopted. In an effort to assess what progress has been made, delegates from around the world will be meeting this week in Montreal at the UN Conference on Climate Change. While the conference will focus on federal government's climate change programs, the David Suzuki Foundation has released a report on the need for action at the level of Canada's provincial and territorial governments. Dale Marshall is the climate change policy analyst at the David Suzuki Foundation. He's the author of All Over the Map, a comparison of provincial climate change plans. And he's joined me by phone this morning. Good morning, Dale.
Good morning, Jane.
Now, it was the federal government that signed on to the Kyoto Protocol, but your report focuses on provincial governments' climate change plans. Why is it so important to focus on the commitments that have been made at the provincial level?
Well, we have to focus on both, and the reason is, as you said, that the federal government's responsible for signing international agreements like the Kyoto Protocol and for implementing them, but the provinces have a lot of jurisdiction in areas that are that have an impact on our greenhouse gas emissions and our climate change plans. For example, the provinces are responsible for natural resource management, like oil and gas sector. The provinces are responsible for the electricity sector. The provinces are also responsible for putting into place building codes that can make our buildings more efficient and reduce the amount of energy that we need and the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that come from them. So the fact that there's not that much so far, hasn't been a lot of cooperation between the federal government and the provincial government, it's really worrisome because we need both of them to be engaged with one another and to be acting cooperatively to address climate change by reducing emissions.
So why does most of the attention then focus on the federal government?
Well, the reason is because they're the ones who in the end are responsible for the implementation of the climate change plan. They're the ones who go into international negotiations, like the one that's coming up in Montreal, and pledge on behalf of the country what we are going to do in terms of climate change action, how we are going to cooperate with other countries. The federal government also has a lot of jurisdiction in other areas that have to do with greenhouse gas emissions. For example, they can regulate vehicle emissions from cars and trucks. They're also responsible for the Large Final Emitters program, which is a program that targets a lot of Canada's industries and manufacturing sector. So there's some jurisdiction that's at the federal level and some jurisdiction that's at the provincial level, which is why they both have to be engaged on the issue and in discussion with each other and acting cooperatively.
How willing have the provincial and territorial governments been to take responsibility for climate change?
Well, some have been quite proactive, but generally the record is poor at the provincial level. There are fewer than half the provinces actually have active climate change plans. Fewer than half the territories have, only one territory has an active climate change plan. If you don't even have a plan to address what is a very serious problem, then it's obvious you're not taking a whole lot of leadership on this. But even the provinces who do have plans, like, for example, British Columbia, many of them don't have actual targets for reducing their emissions, which is a huge problem. The number one way to address climate change is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and if that's not part of your climate change plan, then it's not much of a plan.
So what criteria have you used to evaluate the provincial and territorial climate change plans? I mean, obviously that's just one of them that you just mentioned, but
yeah.
What other criteria have you come up with?
I looked at different criteria, like whether they have a climate change plan, whether they've reduced their emissions, whether they have a target to reduce their emissions, and then looked at individual sectors, like have they addressed emissions from transportation, which is a very big segment of the emissions that come from just about every province. Have they looked at policies to address emissions from the electricity sector? What about buildings? What about government operations? So basically looked at 12 different criteria to see to what extent the provinces have really engaged on this issue.
Have any of the provinces across the country been particularly successful at addressing climate change?
Well, to be honest, the answer, unfortunately, is no. Based on the criteria, I evaluated Manitoba's plan as being the best plan. And one of the big reasons is it actually sets a target that's comparable to the federal government's Kyoto target. And it has put into place a bunch of policies in different sectors. But its emissions are up since 1990. Now, it plans to reduce those emissions by 2010. But all of the, across the country, emissions are up in every single jurisdiction except for the Yukon, which is kind of a specific case where they shut down a mine at some point that had huge emissions. That's why their emissions have gone down. But there are, to be fair, though, there are governments like the Manitoba government that has put into place a fairly strong plan, and there are other provinces that have no plan, and there are a few provinces that have plans that are, I would say, weak and vague and don't really amount to very much.
How is BC doing in that? Do we have a plan here?
We do, and I would put BC in that last category. It has a plan. It doesn't have any emission reduction targets, and it frankly has a very weak plan that doesn't include a lot of the kinds of policies that we would like to see. Mostly, most of its policies would increase emissions. It talks about, for example, improving road infrastructure. What we didn't know when it released the plan was that meant the twinning of Highway 1 out into the suburbs.
This is part of the plan to reduce emissions under the Kyoto Accord,
This is strategic infrastructure improvements is how they put it in the plan. And it came out a few months later that what that meant was the twinning of the Portman Bridge and the Highway 1. So then obviously that will only increase emissions. Part of its plan is also talks about continued production of fossil fuels, oil and natural gas. Again, something that will increase emissions, not decrease emissions. So overall, the plan, I'd say, is quite disappointing. The one area that I sort of had applauded in the past when I looked at BC's overall energy plan, and it was also included in its climate change plan, was a promise to improve the Energy Efficiency Act, to upgrade the standards for a lot of equipment and appliances so that those would become more efficient and have to use less energy and have lower emissions. But what's happened since then is they've actually updated the Energy Efficiency Act, and none of the new standards are mandatory. They're all voluntary, which is hugely disappointing. Both in BC and elsewhere, there have been all kinds of voluntary initiatives that have gone nowhere. And so we were advocating, a more aggressive approach that includes regulations. That's really the only way that we can see emissions actually going down.
Is there anything in the BC plan about alternative forms of energy? Because here in Vancouver, you do hear there's little individual projects happening here and there around alternative forms of energy. But is it in the provincial plan?
They have some discussion about especially alternative electricity sources, and the province has a plan to have 50% of its electricity come from what it's called BC Clean Electricity, and part of that will be things that are truly renewable, like micro hydro projects and like wind projects. But unfortunately, what is included in clean electricity is, for example, cogeneration, so the use of fossil fuels, natural gas and coal to produce electricity. It also includes the burning of municipal solid waste, which has really important impacts on toxics, for example. So, there are things that can be given sort of a lukewarm response. We would like to see that target. In fact, BC Hydro's own records show that BC could use only renewable energy to add to its electricity mix, and we would have enough electricity for the next 20 years. That's the kind of target we would like to see, 100% renewable electricity that gets that gets added over the next two decades.
Now, the federal government's plan focuses on reducing greenhouse gas emissions between the years 2008 and 2012. Do any levels of government in Canada have plans for what would happen after 2012?
No.
No. So it just all ends in 2012?
That's the problem. That's a huge problem. And it's mostly problematic, I would say, at the federal level, because we're going into a climate change conference in Montreal next week. And at that meeting, Canada is going to be chairing the meeting, and we're going to be discussing, negotiating over what is going to happen after the first phase of Kyoto ends in 2012. And Canada has no policies beyond 2012. It has no targets for greenhouse gas emissions after that date. So our negotiators are essentially walking into that, as far as we know. I mean, it could be that they have a secret plan that they haven't revealed to us. But as far as we know, the negotiators are going into that plan completely blind. They're negotiating more about what they can get as opposed to what is really needed to stabilize the climate. And what is needed are deep emission reductions after 2012, and we're hoping that comes out of it. But without the kind of leadership that the federal government should be taking to tell our negotiators, here's what we need, here's what we want to see, and because this is what's needed, it's hard to be optimistic.
So is this a lack of political will, or is it like turf wars between the different levels of governments? Like, why is it so hopeless?
Well, there has been a certain amount of turf wars going on, and there are provinces that have pushed back on the feds, and particularly the oil and gas rich jurisdictions. Alberta and Saskatchewan have both really gone into negotiations very hard nosed. Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, Labrador, and even BC have pushed back at the federal government quite a bit. But in terms of setting the long-term targets and in terms of implementing the full Kyoto plan, that really does rest at the federal level, and we haven't seen the kind of leadership that would be required. We haven't seen goal setting for the long term, which is really what is needed if we're going to address climate change.
Well, it was nice talking to you again this morning, Dale. Thanks for taking our call.
No problem. It was good talking to you, Jane.
I've been speaking with Dale Marshall. He's climate change policy analyst at the David Suzuki Foundation. You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
Soulless, a play by local playwright Aaron Bushkovsky, was first performed in 2002, but it's being revived at the Freddie Wood Theatre at UBC, and Laura Lamb saw the show, and she's joined me in the studio now with her observations. Good morning.
Hi, Mordecai.
So, what is the play about?
It's ostensibly a murder mystery. There's a death. So it's built on the kind of classic dramatic device of the whodunit. But that's really not that important in the play. It's really more of a scaffolding to hold a critical examination of what one critic has called the moral, psychological, and spiritual bankruptcy of Vancouver, as portrayed by these emblematic characters, emblematic Vancouverites, I suppose you could say.
That's quite a set of three words, and it's a pretty scathing condemnation of our city, which some people like to say, oh, it's the most wonderful city in the world. So who are these emblematic characters, these Vancouverites, who are morally, psychologically, and spiritually bankrupt?
Well, there's five characters in the play. There's a housing activist. There's a privileged woman who works in an art gallery, and there's a photographer, an artist, who also has a day job as a real estate agent. yeah.
Like that one.
Yeah, you're starting to get it. But the real bankrupt, I suppose, characters, the most important characters in the play, are kind of somewhat stereotyped characters. There's a lawyer who is very similar to many lawyers we've seen in the movies, right? Kind of a popular stereotype, one who says there is no such thing as truth. Truth is relative. Ethics are meaningless. What's really important is his skill to manipulate that flexibility of meanings in the client's favor, and whether someone is innocent or guilty means nothing. And he's a kind of sharp-tongued verbal bully, you know, that you might expect. And then he also has a kind of a philosophical side and a artificionado side. So he's a film lover who at one point muses about how films have changed from a theme of can I trust this person to can I trust this situation to can I trust my own perceptions. So he's a bit deep. And then there's the other bankrupt character, I suppose, is another person we all love to hate, the real estate developer, right? So he is also a kind of cynical professional who can deliver a lot of clever one-liners. So this kind of the witticisms of these two characters carry the play along, you know, give us a lot of laughs. So this character, he can move from touchy-feely kind of ad speak, like saying, I believe in giving people a chance to live happy ever after, to what I thought was one of the best lines in the play. When he's asked, where is Vancouver's heart? He says, we have atmosphere. We don't need heart. If you want heart, go to Winnipeg.
That's your home.
Yes. That really... So, I got a laugh out of me.
I bet. So, but you'd want to know more. What is the heart and the soul that the author thinks Winnipeg has and Vancouver simply doesn't?
Well, yeah, that's kind of the big question that is only kind of hinted on. And I think it's a possibly an oversimplification on my part to simply define that as being a disconnect with history that Vancouver has, and of course from community. And that's why the whole real estate saga, the developer who's taking a heritage building, which in the play was slated for social housing, but it's now going to be high-end condos, and this is kind of a perfect emblem for this soul sickness.
Is this presented as really unique to Vancouver, this the soullessness?
Well, yeah, Vancouver is specifically referenced many, many times in the play. And that really resonated with me because I agree. I think there is something soulless about Vancouver. And it led me to a couple of more concrete examples because the play is a bit amorphous about it. It hints at this historical problem because... throughout the play, the set is made by projections, and sometimes instead of those projections describing the actual scene, they are historical photographs. So these come in at various points. So that's what makes me think that Bishkowski is kind of on the same wavelength here as I am, and I have a couple of more concrete examples that really describe what I started to think about. One is a tract that was written by my late dear friend Fred Douglas, who is an artist and a writer. Just before he died, he was writing this thing about the downtown East Side and how that moniker is really marginalizes an area of the city, which is not a marginal area, which should never be a marginal area because it's not an other place. It's not that place over there, the downtown East Side. It's actually central Vancouver. It is Vancouver. And by accepting this nomenclature, by saying, oh, yes, right, it's the downtown East Side and Vancouver is somewhere else, that's kind of a massive forgetting. And even the people who are critical, like activists and artists, accept that. And that's sort of a symptom of our social amnesia. So there's that. And then I also thought about the title of this book, which I once saw in someone else's house and never had a chance to completely read. But it's a book about the history of British Columbia. It's called The Rush for Spoils, and about how capitalists came in here and could make money really fast on the resources, on the timber and the fish and so on. And that rush now is in real estate. It's the speed of the greed here. And I think that's kind of the economic base, you might say, for this malaise.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a city that the rush for greed, the speed of destruction. I mean, you go past every place in your own neighborhood, and nothing remains the same. A house
choom, disappears, and you wonder, what was there before? And it's constantly reconstructed, but it's ahistoric. It becomes less and less history.
Yeah, so the characters in the film keep saying things like, we're all disconnected, we've lost our humanity, and what the hell is wrong with us? So it's this malaise which they can't put their finger on.
But the soulless play is advertised, publicized as a play about redemption. So are the characters or the city in the telling of the story, is there some brightness that happens, that comes to the fore?
Well, I didn't really see that in the play. There is one character who moves to change her personal situation, and the lawyer and the developer sort of have the arrogance knocked out of them by the end of it. But the only kind of redemption is this hint of that sexual romantic love can make people happy. So that was hinted at.
Did you go away feeling love conquers all?
Well, I think Bushkovsky kind of almost takes that way out, and I think that's a weakness in the play. But he knows too much to really make a happy ending. But then there is another kind of redemption that he also plays with, which I think he deals with in a very strong way. He just crushes it. The idea that that art can be a panacea, that art can be our redemption, that artists are somehow innocent in the character of the photographer, the artist, who he emerges at the end as more smug, more self-serving than anyone else in the play. So it's he's possibly the most soulless character by the end, whereas the other characters have sort of dropped their self-satisfaction. He's still congratulating himself, and he's saying, a person like me comes along to illuminate things. So yeah, I thought that was the most interesting approach to the idea of redemption, and he really just smashes it.
So it's very clear that is the satirized or exposed,
yeah,
as opposed to affirmed as somehow events, something genuine.
Yes, yeah, the events of the play put a lie to it.
Well, the question about all reviews, do you recommend going to the play?
Yes, I do. I enjoyed it. It was very well done. And, you know, as you can tell from what I've been saying, it stimulated a lot of thinking. And I think, just as to sum up, because he was the author, when an author puts an artist, proclaimed artist, in a play, in a way they're always a stand-in for the artist who created the play. And by making the play ultimately critical of the artist, it's also self-critical, and that makes it, to me, a genuine critical endeavor. When you can turn criticism, it's easy to attack developers and lawyers. Everybody does that, but to turn it on yourself, I think that's something to see.
Thanks a lot, Laura. I've been speaking with Laura Lamb about the play Soulless. It's running until the 3rd of December. That's next Saturday. So you have a full week to see it, and it's at the Frederick Wood Theatre, which is on the UBC campus.